I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
This is a little song about a boy that I like to see. I love his smile. His name is Dodo Moin. He's my little chéri. Dodo Moin, pas moi en sourire.
All right, okay, Bernie, we have to stop dancing in the studio and get started and sit down and do the show.
Okay, Carol, we'll control ourselves. We'll be dignified just for a minute, but that's about all. Okay, hi, this is Bernie Wides and
Carol Butler.
And back on the air, the Naturalist Show. And this week, we're going to talk about my trip to Belize, which was a very nice trip. And it was sponsored by the new name of Elder Hostel, which is called Road Scholar.
Okay.
Even though there aren't any roads where I went to, it was called Road Scholar.
Right.
And it was a joint program with the Oceanic Society, and it was a service trip. That means you go and do some work. And I was there for 2 weeks. The first week was on dolphin research, and the second week was on tropical reef research. So I'm going to do the one on tropical reef research now because I just got home late Saturday night at 2 in the morning, and these I sent Jack a bunch of pictures, which were easy for me to put on. And if you want to see pictures of what I'm talking about, go on to the site, and there'll be a little place that says "See Photos." Is that right, Jack? Look and see the photos.
There'll be a few on the Heritage page, and then if you want to see
more pages,
there'll be a link to Flickr where we can have a bigger display.
Okay, so very briefly, I want to welcome some folks that I met down there. We had a terrific group. I'll just read their names quickly, and I'm going to put you on my listserv you'll get notices. Okay, Molly Bean, Janet David, my partner, Victoria Harris, Marty and Bernie Kroll, another Bernie.
Uh-huh.
My age group. There's no little kids named Bernie. Bill and Phyllis McKenzie, Terrence Quirk, Peter Randazzo, and our leader was Garv Hofler. So the setup was this. We volunteered to go down there, and of course we had to pay because they need the money. And they have a research station on this island. It's called an atoll. It's called Turnip Atoll. Yeah, we flew into Belize City, and we took a bus to the dock, and we had to take a boat to get out to Turnip Atoll.
Very nice.
It was an hour and a half boat ride, and you know, once you get on to tropical waters, the water changes color.
Yes.
And it was really beautiful. When you start out, if you're in a deep place, the water's that blue like we know about our Atlantic, but then when you get to places where the water is shallower, and you have the white sand on the bottom, you get this beautiful turquoise color that's the Caribbean is famous for.
We used to fly a small plane, and we would fly in the Caribbean and just marvel at the changes
sand.
In color in the water. Yeah.
So I want to welcome those people to my listserv, which I'll do tonight, so you'll all be on it for the show.
Very good.
And the topic was, let me get it from their site here, Turnip Atoll Coral Reef Monitoring Research Plan, okay, from the Oceanic Society. Well, we went on this trip because we had gone with Oceanic Society many years ago to Costa Rica, and we did a thing on humpback whales, which was a lot of fun. So we figured we'd do this one because it was two of my favorite things, tropical reefs and dolphins.
Right.
And the way it worked was that there was a little sadness involved because a hurricane came through in October and really destroyed the research station. Mm. So when we got down there, it wasn't really livable yet. They had told us that we would be staying at a Blackbird Key Resort, which is about 10-minute walk from the research station. So actually, we were glad to stay at that resort because it was really very nice. And the atoll is made up of many keys. And keys, like if you go to Key West, mm-hmm. you go through all those chain of keys to get down there.
Little islands.
They're little islands. Right. So a key is spelled C-A-Y-E, and it means a small island.
Right.
And so we were on Blackbird Key, which was part of a bigger group of Turnip Atoll.
Why don't you set the stage by telling the listeners what you told me about your neighbors on either side from where you were staying, because it's a beautiful example of what it's like to be down there.
And I didn't put pictures up of these critters because we can't put that many on the site. But we had these very nice cabins, or cabanas, as they call them, because there's a lot of Spanish spoken there. And on one side of us was a cabana. It was about 20 feet away. And I was in the bathroom one morning, standing there and looking out the window, and there I see this iguana on the roof next door. And I was wondering, what are they doing on the roof? But what they were doing on the roof was they were living on the roof. Now, picture like a bungalow shape, one-story building, with a shingled roof. And between the roof and the siding on the house, there was a drain, you know, a downspout to catch the rain and all that. And the roof had lifted up a little bit. So these two iguanas were living in that space.
And you said they were very, very big.
One of them was about 4 feet long.
Wow.
And I couldn't imagine how he could fit in there, but he did. Yeah. And the other one was about 2 feet.
Wow.
So what would happen in the morning is, when the sun was up and it was getting nice and warm, they would come out and spend their day, half of the day, up on the roof. And they do this interesting thing is they do, it's like push-ups. And I think it's a dominance thing because the big one was doing it all the time,
probably
showing
the
he's the king of the roost.
Right.
Yeah. And they stand around, they look up, and they look around, and then they push the head up and down and up and down. But it was really nice. So every day we said hello to those guys. And on the other side of us, there was one more cottage, and then it was a forest. And there was a family of ospreys living there. So every morning we would hear that there were two or three chicks in the nest. They would start crying. They're hungry. You know, they want their breakfast. So either the mom or the dad would fly off to the sea, which we were right next to, the Caribbean, and bring back breakfast for the kiddies.
Wow.
So that was the setting. And our cottage was right on the beach. If you look straight out from our little porch, there it was. There was the Caribbean. Beautiful colors. So anyhow, the reefs. Why were we there to help out with the reefs? Okay, because coral reefs are a unique ecosystem, and they are endangered all over the earth because of many things. So the Oceanic Society has started a research program. They've been doing it for 10 years on the same reef to accumulate data to see the changes in the reef. Okay? So the reefs that we used are what are called patch reefs.
Hmm.
Okay? They're different kind of reefs.
Patch reefs.
Patch reefs.
Okay.
Patch reefs are a reef that's probably 30, 40, 50, 60 feet long or around, and it's just right there. Now, there are fringing reefs that go all around the atoll, and if you looked out from the shoreline about 300 to 400 feet offshore, you saw waves breaking. And that's not normal because out there by 300 feet, it should be deep already.
Right.
But it's what happens is the fringing reefs grow up to the surface, and then they stop growing because they have to be in water. So the surf breaks over the reef, and that's how you can spot a reef. If you're a boater, you'll watch for stuff breaking. We have reefs up here, too.
Yes,
that
we
you
do.
Remember when you were boating, you'd have to watch for them?
That's right.
Water breaking over them. Okay, but these were tropical reefs, the famous ones that everybody knows what they look like, with probably 1,000 different inhabitants of fishes and invertebrates and all kinds of critters that live on the reef. And the reefs are the beautiful colors. And I'll tell you why, what makes them the beautiful colors. But so a coral reef is actually a colony of hundreds of tiny polyps.
Right.
The polyps are like tiny little anemones.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knows what an anemone is. You remember from the movie Nemo. Nemo was a clownfish anemone living in this anemone on a reef.
Right.
So we had anemones there, but we didn't really have any clownfish. But anyhow, they're doing research on the status of the reefs. And the reefs are endangered because of A, global warming,
mm-hmm.
B, construction on these keys,
right,
and runoff,
right,
and of course they catch diseases, and and exotic species. Those are a lot of the main reasons that the reefs are endangered. So I'm going to go over some technical stuff about reefs, how they live, and all that. So, Carol, if you have a question, just
I'm interested in hearing about your experience, what you did when you were down there.
That's a good point. So what we did was we had about eight people, and we went out every day in a small boat that was about 20 foot long outboard, and we would go out to the reefs and.
These are not fringe reefs.
No, so these are the patch reefs.
How far off the shore were these reefs?
Not too far off the shore, maybe 20 minutes by boat, 15 minutes. Mm. And the problem was that it was very windy down there. The first day we got down there, there was a storm. We couldn't go out. This big tropical front came through, like a cold front, and it blew up a lot of sediment, and you can't see the reefs too well when the water's
turbid. That's not good when you're only down there for a few days.
So, but by the next day, the wind had died down a little bit. It was still blowing, but we could go out. So what we did was, first we had some lessons on reefs and the lifestyle and what we should be looking for. Mm-hmm. And the reefs have all these different fishes living on them. And we were going to learn how to identify five different kinds of fish.
Oh, great.
Okay? And you would say, well, why did you pick those fish? Because one of the fishes that we identify is a fish that eats algae.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, the reefs grow algae.
Right.
Okay? But if you get too much algae covering the reefs,
smothers,
then the polyps, who are the little critters who make the reefs, they can't get sunlight.
Right.
And you say, why do they need sunlight? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay? So we had to learn about these five different kind of fishes. One is one that eats algae because it helps keep the reefs clean.
Right. I used to try to have those in my fish tank.
Right. To clean the algae that grows on the glass and all that. The second one is one that actually eats the reef itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's two. The next one is a predator that eats the fish that eats the algae.
Right.
And the last one are invasive species.
Okay.
Okay, so we had to learn to identify them. And I put pictures up on the website.
Good.
And go look at the pictures, and you'll see what I was talking about. But I'm just getting ahead of myself a little bit.
No, it's okay.
I just want to talk about how reefs grow and what they actually are. Okay? So, what makes the reefs? The reefs are made by tiny little critters that look like anemones, but they're very small, probably a quarter of an inch across, and that's it. And what they do is they take carbon dioxide and they turn it into calcium carbonate, just like the shellfish do.
Right.
And they make these little cells around themselves. Right. And the critters that do this are called polyps.
Right.
And
I'm picturing a barnacle.
Like a barnacle. Right.
Yeah.
But they can't close up like barnacles can. Barnacles have to be able to close because they're out of the water half the time when their tide goes out. But these polyps can't really close. Well, they can pull their tentacles in.
Mm-hmm.
So they have tentacles out. And what do the tentacles do? The tentacles collect pieces of a protein that are in the water, like from dead critters, from that are naturally in the water.
Right, flotsam and jetsam.
Yeah, flotsam and jetsam, which is mostly from boats, but this is bionic flotsam
exactly,
and jetsam.
Exactly, right.
Okay, but what makes their colors? You see, when you see a piece of reef that somebody brings home on a trip, what color is it?
White.
White.
Yeah.
And because they're called bleached.
Right.
And that's because
they're dead. They're dead.
But what makes the reef the colors? It's not these polyps that live in them. It's something that's living in the polyp.
Mm.
And I'm going to give you a fancy word, Carol.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. And these critters are called zooxanthellae.
Oh, very nice.
Okay. That's a pretty fancy word.
Right.
Sounds like it's Italian, but it's not.
Right.
Zooxanthellae.
Okay,
so these zooxanthellae are a kind of algae. They're called the dinoflagellates.
Right.
And they're one-celled, tiny little critters. And they make the colors of the reefs because they're all different species, and each species produces a different color. So how do they help the polyps? They're living symbiotically with the polyps, okay? The polyps provide a home for them, this nice, secure little reef that they build,
right.
calcium carbonate home, and they provide water, changing water for them because right. the polyps are always circulating water around. And what does the zooxanthellae provide? The zooxanthellae does photosynthesis.
Ah, so.
Okay. So therefore, the reefs have to be kept clean.
Right.
Because if you have a lot of foreign algae growing on the reef, the light won't get through. And the zooxanthellae are not very happy. And you always want to keep your zooxanthellae happy?
That definitely. It's okay. a first rule of thumb.
Okay.
Keep your zooxanthellae happy.
Right. So they have this very nice relationship. Nobody knows how this started, but through evolution, it's like they found each other.
That's right.
And they're living together.
It worked. Till so
death,
they kept doing
till death
it.
Do us part.
Right.
So it's really an interesting symbiotic relationship. So our job as researchers was, A, to see what the health of the reefs are, because a lot of the reefs are dying all over the world, and see these causes. Mm-hmm. Now, right next to our resort, the man who owned all this property was building another one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the problem is this. Okay, all of those keys or islands are covered with mangroves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the main mangrove is the red mangrove,
right.
which lines the shoreline, and you've probably all seen pictures of it. The red mangrove looks like it has tremendous roots that are reaching out into the water.
I have canoed in mangrove swamps.
Yes.
It's great fun.
It's great. They're really a very important tree.
Right.
So just very quickly, if you picture a beautiful tropical island with palm trees and all that, and if there are mangrove trees all around the perimeter of the island, that's the ideal situation. Because every time...
Sounds ideal to me right there.
Right.
I'm ready
You're
to
ready
go.
You're ready to go.
I'm ready to
okay.
go. Trinidad, here I come.
Right. So what happens is when it rains in the tropics and rain falls on the land, okay, if there are no trees on the island, you get a lot of runoff of sedimentation, which
right.
is small sand and right. pebbles and all that stuff. That sediment runs into the water.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You don't want that sediment to reach the reefs.
Right.
Because they'll smother the reefs.
Right.
Okay? So the island should be fringed with red mangrove trees. And in the water, you'll have some sand because of the natural occurrence of sand.
Right.
But you don't want too much sand. And going seaward from the sand, you should have seagrass beds.
Mm-hmm.
Turtle grass, manatee grass. There are all these grasses. They all look pretty much the same. And they work as filters.
Cleans the water.
Cleans
like
the water.
Like the lean on a whale.
Like
right.
the lean on a whale.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you come to the reefs.
Right.
So by the time this water gets to the reef, it should not be turbid. It
right.
shouldn't have any suspended
right. yes.
stuff in it that will choke the reef. So as I said, after that storm when we went out, we saw that there was a lot of sedimentation on the reef. Because from the wind and the waves, it churns up the water and it deposits the sand on the corals and the other plants.
Right.
So that's not very good for them.
Right.
And it's not good to keep their who happy?
Zooxanthellae's
happy.
If I don't have that in front of me, I would never have it.
Okay. So now you know the relationship of the reef to the critters around it. And I'll go into more detail at the second half of the show.
Okay.
But so remember that the reefs are made of these tiny little polyps, each living in a calcium carbonate chamber,
right.
from which they protrude tentacles to gather light and food. That's what I said before. Okay? And all these chambers are connected to us. It makes the whole reef one big giant animal.
Mm-hmm.
So if some polyps are getting more food than others, they can pass the carbohydrates to the rest of the reef.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So they're a giant, giant organism, and they're genetically identical.
Huh.
So it's a huge, huge animal divided up into thousands and millions of little critters, but they're all connected.
I didn't realize that they shared food. That's
they
interesting.
They share food.
Yeah.
And the food is in the form of, sugars.
Right. It's like a commune.
It's like a right. It's one of the world's biggest communes.
Yeah.
And remember, they always tell you don't walk on the reefs, don't step on the reefs,
right.
because you'll crush the polyps, and also because the connecting part of from one polyp to the next sometimes goes through the sand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you step on it and you crush that, you're cutting off a food supply
I see.
To part of the reef. So it's really a very complicated lifestyle. And also, coral reefs are very fussy about where they're going to live. First of all, they're very slow growing, maybe a millimeter a year. So over thousands of years, these coral reefs build up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this great exhibit at our Museum of Natural History and Hall of Ocean Life.
Right.
Where there's a chunk of the reef, the Andros Reef from the Bahamas.
Right. Oh, I remember that.
Yes.
I've been there, yes.
And that's two stories high, that exhibit.
Yep.
The reef is huge. And it must have taken 10,000 years or even more, 100,000 years, for reefs to get that big. So they're very old critters, reefs. And they're very slow growing, and each little animal, as I said, each polyp is tiny. And why you shouldn't walk on the reef is because if you crush a part of the reef, it could take 1,000 years for it to grow back.
Wow.
And also because, as I said, all these cells are connected to each other, and the connection goes right underneath the polyp through the sand. Okay, so it's
a big
colony.
Is it a tube? Do they have like a little tube that connects?
It's like a tube.
I'm just trying to imagine it, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. Because it says, I'm reading from the text I gave it.
Right, okay.
Okay. I'll save that for the second part of the show because I'm getting a signal from Jack to stop. So remember, this is going to be a cliffhanger. I'm leaving you in suspense of what do these fishes do to the reef, why we need them, and how to protect the reefs. And what's the dangers?
All right, we look forward to getting the answer to the mystery.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 3:30 p.m., tune in to We Dig Plants with garden designers Carmen DeVito and Alice Marcus Krieg of Groundworks, Inc. The girls delve into our human relationship with plants as food, medicine, fodder, and a source of beauty and inspiration. They bring the culture to horticulture and discuss such topics as botany how-to, cultivation, horticultural history, garden design trends, and all things generally budding. Again, that's every Sunday at 3:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Wepa! Okay. Settle down.
We are back. We had a quick dance then, but, you know, it's not enough time. But anyhow, we're back on the air. This is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, and Carol Butler, my terrific...
Sorry, I was drinking water. Carol.
Terrific co-host. And we were down in Belize. And
on the reef.
Carol would like to go there right now. Right?
Absolutely. That's, I haven't been to the Caribbean in a long time, but I'm very much thinking about it.
With that great music, right?
Right.
Okay. So we were talking about coral reefs and the dangers to them, the threats to them, and what we actually did when we were down there to collect data. So I'll tell you a little bit more about the reefs themselves, and then I'll tell you about actually what we actually did. Okay, so the reefs, they're very fussy about where they're going to live. So they grow best in warm water, 77 to 85 degrees. If it gets too cold, they're not happy. If it gets too hot, they're not happy.
Mm-hmm.
And what they'll actually do is, it's not clear whether they'll expel their zooxanthellae, or the zooxanthellae just leave because home isn't...
It's not comfortable.
Not comfortable anymore. They're not quite sure about that. But either way, the polyp will die because the polyp needs the zooxanthellae, and the zooxanthellae needs the polyp. You know, if you break up this marriage, it's bad business.
Right, right, right.
Very bad. Okay. So we said it's a whole colony, and this symbiotic relationship, and it establishes the base to the tropical food web, concentrating nutrients and creating a structure which becomes a source of food and shelter for hundreds of other organisms. So when you see pictures of those beautiful reefs, there are always a multitude of different fishes
living there.
Invertebrates and other critters, shrimps, crabs, urchins, and many other critters live on the reef or near it or are protected by it. So the biodiversity, which means the number of plants and animals, found in a community on the coral reefs compared to the rainforest. Right. You know, everybody talks about the rainforest right. with biodiversity. The reefs have the same density of life. Mm-hmm. It says in my notes, the wealth of life that exists on coral reefs is due in part to many of the same factors leading to high density in the rainforest. Right. The habitat is complex, allowing for hundreds of species of algae and animals to live together in one small area. Okay, the warm waters of the tropical seas are generally not very productive in plankton or food. That's why the waters are so clear. You can see down in them. Right. They don't have a lot of plankton in the water. If you looked out, when you went out on the boat, and you couldn't look down and see down. Maybe you could see down a foot
right.
in the North Atlantic.
Right.
Because first of all, there's a lot of sediment coming off the land. And secondly, we have a lot of plankton in our waters. That's why our waters are pretty productive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think of all the big food fish that we eat,
right.
from herrings to cod flounders, to fluke, all the other fishes we eat, they don't come from tropical reefs because tropical reefs don't have huge schools of fish that we eat. They have huge schools of small fish,
right?
But you don't see millions of cod
we
used to have and herring.
I like grouper. You see a
grouper.
You see one going by in
yes.
the coral reef, but you don't see big bunches of them, big schools of them. It's true.
And groupers are being overfished, of course. So,
delicious.
And why the groupers are good for the reef is because they're the predator.
Right.
They eat the smaller fish, right. And it keeps it in balance.
So before we run out of time, I think it's interesting to know what you did.
Okay, I keep...
I know you're interested in conveying all the details of the reef mechanism, but it's also interesting to know what you do on a trip like this.
Okay, so what we did was we got trained to identify these different fish, including a... let's see. Yeah, well, I'll get back to that one later. Exotics that were coming onto the reef.
Invasive species.
Right. Yeah. So here's what we actually did. They gave us slates, which were plastic pieces of plastic about the size of a big book. And on the slates was drawn lines across so we could keep a track of the fish that we saw. And the names of the fish that we were looking for were written on the slate. And you say, well, what good is a slate? You're going to go in the water. Well, we were snorkeling, so we would take the slates with us, and the chief investigator, Garv, would go in the water first and put in a little float buoy. This is right on the reefs.
Mm.
We had to be careful that we didn't touch the reefs. He put a float in, you know, a styrofoam ball, like boats tie up to, like
right.
a mooring.
Yeah.
And then he would take a transect, a tape, and run the tape from that ball across the reef to the other side of the reef about... 200-300 feet away, and then stake it down.
Right.
And there were stakes already in the reef because they've been doing these same reefs for 10 years.
So they could anchor the ball.
And the transect. We were doing transects down on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we had to do was, and teams of two, we would get in the water, and we would start at the ball and time ourselves and give ourselves 10 minutes to go the distance across.
Mm.
And as we moved along the transect, you look down and you could see the numbers on the tape. So we had to gauge ourselves to do the right time, to cover the whole thing in the right time. And what we would do was, let's say the transect is between Carol and myself.
Right.
Okay? So Carol's sitting next to me right now on my right. So she would look at the critters that would be to the right of the tape as we swam along with our snorkels on.
Right.
And note every critter within a meter of the tape. And the ones you were looking for were the fishes that we had to identify.
Right.
Okay. And I would be on the left side of the tape. So we would go along, and when we got to the end of the tape, we would stop there, okay, and turn around and come back.
Right.
And then look for the one I couldn't think of, the spiny sea urchins.
Right.
Because sea urchins live on reefs, and sea urchins help to keep the reefs clean because they eat algae.
Right.
Okay? And they're an important part of the reef.
So the return trip was just to look at sea urchins?
Just to look at sea urchins.
And how did you write this down on this tablet?
It's very tricky.
We're underwater. Right.
The tablet's made of like plastic.
Right.
Okay, and we used a pencil similar to a grease pencil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It didn't feel very greasy, but it was a black carbon pencil, and you could write underwater. Oh. The only thing we had to write were the numbers.
Just, right.
And fill in the numbers.
Like a tally.
Like a tally.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. A couple of times you had a lot of trouble because it was rough.
I can't imagine.
It was rough.
Right, I'm just picturing the swimming and, and trying holding, to stay in the right place
right.
and holding
it
the tablet and writing.
That's why I said to you when I spoke to you on the phone, it wasn't easy.
Right,
we were really working at
it.
So, but whatever data we were able to collect was important because this is a 10-year study.
Yeah,
okay?
Interesting.
So, well, we were on vacation. It was not a sit-on-the-beach vacation.
Exactly.
So we did this 4 out of 5 days. Mm. The first day we had a storm. It was too rough. We couldn't do it. And they had 3 different reefs for us to study. But we didn't get to all 3 of them because the wind was very strong.
Right.
And it was choppy. And, you know, sediment was moving in because of the waves on the fringing reef.
Right.
So we just did 1 reef out of the 3.
And so in on a good trip along your transect, how many individuals would you identify? Like 5, 20? What kind of volume did you see?
It's hard to say because some of the fishes are there in big schools, like the surgeon fishes, which are these beautiful blue fish. They're actually exquisite. And they eat the algae that are living in the reef. So you had to count those. Sometimes you saw 20 or 30 in a group.
Okay.
And they would be used to us because we were right on the surface, and most of the reef fish are down on the reef.
Right.
It must have been 20 feet deep,
right.
Some places 10 feet deep and all that. Sometimes of the bigger predators, we'd only see 1 or 2.
Right. Okay.
Right, like groupers and snappers. Okay, we were just interested in the groupers because they are a major predator of the smaller fish.
Right.
Okay. So, you could picture us, right?
Yes, I'm picturing this, right.
Okay, in this beautiful turquoise water on this beautiful reef, here we are. We have to move along slowly and not let the current sweep you away and do it at the right amount of time and look for these critters down there.
Right.
And for the first day or two, of course, I had trouble with my mask. It was leaking. I had to get the water out of it. And once I dropped the slate to the reef.
Right, this is what I imagine, yeah.
Yeah. And so Garf had to swim down and get the slate back. So
and where are the other people now?
They're doing the same thing.
On a different transect. Okay, so each person has their own line to swim.
Right, we had three transects out, and so we had 2 people on each reef.
Okay.
So 2, that's 6 people.
Right.
And one person was in the boat. And Garf, who was the leader of the whole thing, he was just swimming around, make sure nobody got drowned.
Right.
And we had this boat driver in the boat, a Belizean guy, Richard, who was terrific. And so when you went, before you got in the water, he checked you out. He checked your mask, he checked your fins, and he was like a mother hen.
Very good.
He was terrific. Yeah. Richard, we called him Mother Richard.
Right.
He was a very nice guy. And he would check us. And if somebody looked like they were in trouble, he would throw a ring buoy out so they could just grab onto it to come back to the boat. Because the current was swift. We had to do it in between the 2 tides, okay? Because once the tide starts to run, either it'll take you out to sea or it'll take you back to the beach.
Right.
So it was a tricky operation.
Yeah, it sounds that
But it was very fascinating, and it was a lot of fun.
It sounds
and
wonderful.
And we even got some data.
Right.
But, you know, it only took up, let's see, it would take up 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon. By the time we got in the boats and we drove out to the reeds.
It was really like a full-time job.
It was a full-time job.
Yeah,
that's
why
I'm going to go on vacation next week.
Right.
So it would take about 3 hours to do it.
Yeah.
And we were partially successful. It wasn't complete success because there's so many things that prevent it from being successful, like the tide and the all that stuff. And one spot we went to, we had to move because the University of Belize has established a research station on this same Blackbird Key that we were on. So they had a reef that they had to use all the time because they had all these young kids. They were like freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a university. And they picked a spot where they could stand on the bottom while they're being trained.
Right.
You know, it was very shallow. And then they could get on the reef. So one time we had to move from there because they had priority over us. And all that. But it was, we had a terrific group of people. The leader, Garp, was very good.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of good lectures. on many other things.
And how was the food?
The food was very good.
What did you have? Fish?
We had a lot of fish and shrimp, but most of it was frozen.
Mm. Oh, yeah, that's what I was wondering.
Because there's no big food supply on the island. Yeah. Everything had to be brought out by boat. But the kitchen staff was excellent, and the food was very good. What was nice was, even though, let's say, the fish was frozen or the shrimp were frozen, they had these delicious sauces.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were based on, you know, like mangoes and local fruits.
Mm-hmm.
So the food was very good. And the facility was lovely. We walked over to see the research station, which looked in terrible shape. They were rebuilding it, and they said to me by
was
the end...
Because of the hurricane?
The hurricane.
Yeah, yeah.
Hurricane had destroyed half the buildings.
Yeah, wow.
And the palm trees were down. And they, you know, they have a big building where everybody gets together, like the dining hall.
Mm-hmm.
And they have another big building like a lecture hall. So, and those buildings were made of fronds, leaves.
From the palm trees.
Yeah,
right.
From palm trees or other trees. And they were conical shaped.
Right.
Round and conical.
Mm-hmm.
So the roofs have been blown off by the hurricane, and the insides had been, you know, flooded.
Sure.
So they knew the hurricane was coming. They packed up all this stuff and put it away. But they're still unpacking. Like, I asked Garf if they have a microscope to use. I wanted to use it. He said, we haven't unpacked those instruments yet. First, we have to get the buildings back in shape and all that. So they have a big job there to do it. So the money we paid to go on this trip normally would go for the research that we were doing, to buy equipment and all that kind of stuff and all that. But they were using a lot of the money to rebuild the station.
So you made a good contribution as well.
Yes. So, Jack, how much time left? And this is the second section?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so I have to mention this one fish.
Sure.
This is fascinating. The parrotfish.
Yes.
Now, you would recognize the parrotfish when you see him, even if you never saw a parrotfish.
No, I've seen them. I recognize them.
Because the face looks like a parrot.
Yes, yes.
So there's one fish called the stoplight parrotfish. Okay? And in its adult phase, it has a white line between the body and the tail.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's called the stoplight parrotfish.
Okay.
Now, what is a parrotfish's lifestyle? The other fishes I spoke about, the surgeon fish and the butterfly fish, they eat the algae that's growing on the coral that you know prevents the photosynthesis. The parrotfish actually eat the coral.
Right.
So you might say, why is that a valuable fish? Because they actually bite off chunks of coral, and they have these grinding teeth, and they grind up what they eat, and then they excrete it out the rear end. And if you walk on a tropical beach, that's where a lot of the sand comes from, the parrotfish.
Right.
So they're valuable because they make the beaches.
Right.
And secondly, they're valuable because they take care of the reefs. Even though they eat some of the reef, they take care of it.
It probably stimulates new growth, too.
Yeah, but they are there, and nobody messes around with the parrotfish because they're, you know, they're keepers of the reef, really. So they're a very interesting fish. Because you know there's a beautiful white sand, so you're actually walking on fish poop.
Right.
So you know every critter has its own lifestyle.
That's right.
And own niche, and everybody knows how beautiful reefs are, and the Caribbean, this reef, the fringing reef, is the biggest one in the Caribbean.
Mm.
It goes all the way from Mexico down to I think Panama.
Wow.
And these Apache reefs that we snorkeled on are inside the protection of the fringing reefs.
Now, is the fringing reef like a version of the Great Barrier Reef?
Right.
It's the same type of
thing.
The
same thing. Yeah. Yep. When I was in Australia on the Great Barrier Reef, it was the same thing. Mm. There's this huge reef, and then on this huge reef, there are patch reefs that, you know, take root and whatever it is and all that and grow. So, this is the biggest one in Mesoamerica, is the one off the coast of Belize. And there's a very famous place called the Blue Hole.
Yes. Oh, yes. I remember that from diving days.
Yes. So they took people out on a day trip, whoever hadn't been to the Blue Hole, to snorkel out there. I had been there and Janet had been there before, so we didn't go. But the Blue Hole it's about an hour off the coast of Belize. And it's a terrific place for snorkeling and diving. Divers love it.
It was a dive
paradise.
Site, yeah.
So it's probably a half a mile across, and all the critters swim in a big circle, in the Blue Hole, And if you're a diver, you certainly can go down deeper and see some of the fish that don't usually come to the surface. But so the blue hole is very unique. And the blue hole is the result of, there was a lot of volcanic activity in the Caribbean years ago. And this is, the blue hole is a result of a sinkhole forming in the lava.
Yeah.
From a volcano.
Interesting.
So it's a very famous place, and now it's a park in Belize, which is very nice.
Right.
And you have to pay a fee to go there, but it's good. They're taking care of it.
They take care of it, right.
And Belize, and one of the reasons that Oceanic Society is doing all their research, they want Blackbird Key to become a UNESCO heritage site.
Okay.
To preserve it.
Sounds like a wonderful destination.
Because if they don't preserve it, what's going to happen is more and more resorts will be built on there. Right now, let's see. Turniff Atoll, which is which our little key, a Blackbird Key, was part of, is 30 miles long. There are only three resorts on there now in the 30 miles, including the research station.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's not protected soon, they're going to keep building because it's such a great spot.
Yeah.
And, you know, every time you build a resort, it degrades the water more and more.
Right.
Because you get runoff and all that stuff. And I had a tour by the guy, the manager who runs it, Phil. I said, Phil, you know, you're isolated from the shoreline. What about your utilities? How does that work? He said, well, we're drinking seawater.
Hmm.
Okay. So I said, oh, you're doing...
Desalination.
Yeah. He said, yes, we are. I said, well, can I see the process? He said, sure. So he shows me this pipe coming out of the ocean, the Caribbean Sea, I should say, not the ocean.
Right.
Okay, it wasn't very big diameter. Maybe it was about a 3-inch diameter pipe. And they pump it up, and at the end of the pipe in the water, there's a screen.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps out big sediments and big particles.
Right.
And the water goes to a sand filter first.
Hmm.
Now, I asked him if it was a diatomaceous earth filter, which they use in pools.
Yes.
He really didn't know, but it was a huge cylinder.
They use it when they're trying to get rid of bed bugs, too.
Yeah, they do, but that's not safe to do.
Right, I know. It's not a good solution, but they use it a lot.
Yeah. So anyhow... So it goes through the sand filter, and then it goes through paper cartridge filters.
Right.
And so this filters out a lot of the sediment in the water, you know, pieces of rock, pieces of, you know, critters that have died and all that, you know, stuff you wouldn't want to have in your drinking water. Okay. Then it goes to a machine that does a reverse osmosis process. And what this reverse osmosis process does, it has a membrane in it, like we have around our cells.
Right.
Our cells have a semi-permeable membrane, which just lets in what the cell needs from the interstitial fluid flowing around it. This is very similar to that. So what it does is they force the water under pressure through the membrane.
Mm.
The membrane lets the H2O molecule go through. But the sodium chloride molecule, salt, can't go through the membrane.
It's bigger, yeah.
Okay, so it's called a reverse osmosis process because they're doing it under pressure.
Mm.
That's what everybody's doing now. Israel is using this on a grand scale to desalinate their water.
Right.
The problem is it's an expensive proposition,
yeah.
But it works beautifully. So I said to him, do you add anything to the water? He says, no.
Wow.
And we were drinking the water from the tap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a lot of third world countries, you can't do that.
Right.
But this process worked beautifully. And we had all the water we needed, except you need electricity. How do you get electricity on an island, you know, an hour and a half from the coastline? With generators. They have big diesel generators.
Noisy. Yeah.
Noisy. Luckily, they were away from all the cottages.
Smelly sometimes.
Yeah. So they had two or three of these diesel engines running the generators, so we had electricity.
Uh-huh.
So that was solved. And I said, what about sewage? What do you do with sewage? He said, you know, it's all sand here.
Mm.
So... Behind every two cottages, they would hook together. They would have a septic system, like a leaching field.
Yeah.
They had concrete boxes. The waste goes into the concrete boxes, and because most of the waste is water, it drains into the sand.
Right.
And the solid part goes into another chamber, and by natural digestion of bacteria, it breaks down.
Right.
So
quite something.
Yeah, so they, you know, they have to be self-reliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if there's a hurricane, they're not going to be able to get to the mainland.
Right.
They have enough fuel to run the generators. So it was a very impressive operation.
Very interesting.
And the guy who runs it, he had to be a jack of all trades because there was always something breaking down.
Sure.
Or this and that and all that. And they were still recovering from the hurricane. Even the boat dock that we used, half of it had been wrecked.
Wow.
So there were crews out there repairing the docks. And at the research station, they must have had 40, 50 people working on it.
Right.
And some of the people working on it are Mennonites.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
The Mennonites have established a presence in Belize. I know they have big dairy farms. So if you're in Belize, you can drink the milk because they pasteurize the milk. Mm. You can eat the ice cream.
Wow.
It comes from the Mennonite dairy farms. Mm. And they grow a huge amount of vegetables.
And do they come out for the day or do they live on the island when they're working?
These guys stay there all week.
Mm. I guess they put them up on the weekend.
Yeah, it takes an hour and a half to commute.
Yeah.
So they went home on the weekend.
Right.
So they were working hard to fix up the research station. So if you're looking for an interesting experience.
It sounds wonderful,
and
yeah.
The next group will be in March. But I would tell you not to go this year because the research station is in terrible shape yet.
Yeah.
Even though they're going to let people come out and go there, don't go this year. Go next year when everything will be back up to speed and you'll have a great experience there. The only negatives are they have some of the nasty biting flies like you find in salt marshes.
Yeah.
But when with the wind blowing, it
wasn't
sort of,
too bad.
It wasn't too bad, except when the wind died down at night. And the research you're doing is valid research, and you're taking care of one of the threatened ecosystems on Earth. So it was a very nice trip, and this is part one of my Belize trip.
Wonderful. We're looking forward to part two and maybe part three. We'll see.
Yeah, we never know what's going to happen, of
right.
course.
So that's the naturalist.
So next week will be part one.
Okay.
I mean, and this was part one.
Next week
and
will
this
be,
dolphins. Next week.
Yes.
And the week after will be dolphins.
Very good. I'm very excited.
Okay.
All right. Terrific.
Signing off.
Wonderful music again. Thank you, Jack. This is Carol Butler.
And Bernie Wise.
All right. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Foods USA. In late March, Dan, Andrea, Patrick, and the Heritage team are traveling to the coldest reaches of the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont to help the Cantor family tap sugar maple trees. Then the maple sap will flow down to the sugar house where it is boiled gently over a wood fire just as it has been for generations. Just a few days later, this grade A amber syrup will be poured into the beautiful glass jugs and sent to you for pancakes, waffles, desserts, glazing hams, or just drinking by the spoonful. There's only a limited supply, so order today. Each 1-liter bottle is $45, including delivery. Delivery will be at the end of March, and we will notify you of the exact shipping date. Each shipment will include a CD explaining the whole process. You can also follow us on YouTube while we work and bottle. In the meantime, you can head over to the Heritage Radio Network archives and listen to Linda Palacio talk about maple syrup on her show, A Taste of the Past, Episode 12. For more information, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com. The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Wine Impresarios Aaron Fitzpatrick and Brian DeMarco as they dish out on the latest industry news with winemakers and tastemakers on Heritage Radio Network's revamped wine show, Unfiltered. Erin Fitzpatrick, one of the first hosts on HRN with her program At the Root of It, amps up the volume and unfiltered content with co-host Brian DeMarco in this 2011 Redux. True to the original format, Erin and Brian will keep you abreast of current happenings and break down the news and global events, distilling complex into anecdotal stories that inspire. From media and political events to hailstorms in Argentina, no topic is out of bounds. Tune in every week to hear them chat up the industry's biggest personalities and host on-air tastings with visiting vintners and the country's hottest sommeliers. Whether you're an expert or an enthusiast, Unfiltered demystifies wine and lets you know what it really takes to get a bottle from the vineyard to your neighborhood wine shop. Unfiltered broadcasts live every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.